I'd like to welcome everyone to Spotlight today. We appreciate your indulgence with our technical difficulties today. Thank you so much for staying with us. It's going to be worth the wait. A couple of things. I'd like to ask everyone to hold their questions and comments of our guest today till the end of the interview. And as always, no text messaging in this room. Thanks to Dennis for his technical expertise in recording Spotlight for us for archives. And with that, I'll turn it over to Steve Pallett to introduce his guest today. Steve?
Okay, thank you very much, Becky. And at long last, I'm going to introduce to you someone who's very, very well known on the site, someone who's made a fantastic contribution to For the People. It's Mr. Shepherd, Steve Shepherd. Steve, thanks very much for agreeing to be interviewed. And can I just begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about your early childhood? Where and when were you born, Steve?
Well, hi, Steve and everybody. Thanks a lot for having me, and thanks for hanging in with these delays. I'm Steve Shepherd, and was born in Richmond, Virginia in 1956. And I have two older sisters, and I had a twin brother. He died in 1994. My mother passed away a couple of years ago, and my father is still living. And, well, what else, Steve? That's the beginning.
And you've always lived in Richmond, Virginia. Can you tell us a little bit about your early memories, your early childhood? Were you born blind, or did that sight problem occur a little bit later?
Ah, yeah. Well, when I was 2 years old, I was jumping down some steps with my brother. We were playing. My parents told us not to do it, but we did it anyway, and I broke my leg and a femur bone clean through, and was in traction for 6 weeks in the hospital. And sometime after that, or around that time, I started to walk funny in the backyard. My mother noticed and took me to the doctor, and they didn't know what was going on or what the problem was. And then I had a lot of pain in my legs and arms and muscles. And so they sent me to a hospital in New York when I was 5 or 6 to be tested after a lot of tests and stuff. I started losing my vision sometime around kindergarten or first grade, and it started going downhill. In the beginning of first grade, I could see the blackboard, and week by week, they had to move my desk up closer and closer to the blackboard. Until the end of the year, I was right up on the blackboard, very isolated from the rest of the class, because the class, the students' little desks were in the back two-thirds of the room, and I was right up on the blackboard. And then it got worse and worse. I'm partially sighted still, and it sort of leveled off, and I can see enough for mobility, getting around, and I see colors and shapes and objects and blue sky, and but I don't read or drive, and I don't see the details. I'm also in a wheelchair. That the muscle problem progressed, and progresses slowly. That used to be called Bear Syndrome. Now it doesn't really have a name per se, but only a generic description, and it's called spastic paraparesis with ataxia and optic atrophy. So that's the name of that.
Wow, that's easy for you to say. Okay, Steve. So when you were first at school, I take it you were at school with able-bodied pupils and students. Did that pose any difficulty at this time, apart from the not being able to see the blackboard? Was your mobility impaired at the school?
Well, yes, it was, and I would tire real easily, and by lunchtime, be in quite a bit of pain, and I'd be crying, and it was quite a problem at that time. Now, my parents always would tell me that at that time, they didn't know what was the neurological problem, and neither did any of the doctors. They didn't know at the time whether I would live or die, and it was a scary time for them. And I think it was a scary time for me, too, because of that, even though I didn't understand. And they told me it was growing pains, and I would grow out of them. And we tried to minimize it and whatnot. I would miss a lot of time from kindergarten and first grade because of it. And I think at that time, I really learned to love school. Or at least love learning, because it was sort of my refuge, you know. The teacher would bring to me the assignments, and I would do them, and I was actually ahead of the class in doing them, and it was sort of the thing that turned me on. It always has been learning, and this is my idea about education is, you don't really have to be super intelligent to excel in education. You only need to be interested. You have to want to learn. And that's what, with me, learning really turned me on. I'm not really above average in intelligence, but I love learning. And that kind of sustained me during that time.
So you threw yourself into learning during this period, because I suppose you weren't able to get out and interact with kids in the neighborhood. I imagine you were probably limited in what you could do when you were going through this period of physical problem. Any subjects which you really enjoyed studying at this time? What did you really like doing?
Well, I loved it all except for spelling. I remain a terrible speller. I loved arithmetic, and I always thought I would be a mathematician when I was a young child. Whatever that was, who knows, I didn't know what that was, but I knew I loved arithmetic. And I was isolated, but I wasn't. My parents did their very best to give me all the experiences and all the advantages, all the childhood things that anyone else had. And so, I learned to ride a bike, but then due to the muscle problem, I couldn't ride anymore, and then I learned again. And same with swimming. I learned to swim when I was two, but then after the breaking of the leg, and I had to learn to walk again. Then I had to learn to swim again. And so it was a lot of losing abilities and trying to regain them. But I was very, very fortunate in the parents I had and what they tried to do for me.
Was there ever a suggestion, Steve, that you should go away to school for the blind or school for physically disabled people? Or did you fight against that, or was that suggestion never made to your parents?
Steve, I never knew it at the time, but yes, lots of people told my parents that I needed to go to a blind school. My parents did not want me to. This was in the early 60s, and that was probably the only choice, unless you had parents like mine. My mother would write out the school books, the textbooks, in magic marker for me, so that large enough so that I could see it. They supported me with readers. They would hire people to read to me and help me do the schoolwork. It was visual in the elementary school. So I was really fortunate again to have the parents. And also, we were not poor. We weren't rich, but we were comfortable enough that Dad was able to afford some things for me that I know that not a lot of people couldn't have. And I went to public school all the way through elementary school and then junior high school. And then I went to a private school, prep school here in Richmond.
I think your public schools are our private schools, what we would call a private school over here in the UK. I think that's correct anyway. Has your physical difficulties, have they stabilised? Did they reach a point and then stabilise, or have they continued to ebb and flow during your life?
Well, they pretty much leveled off during my teenage years. And even through my 20s, I think somewhere in my mid-30s, it started to progress again. There really isn't a roadmap that's known for this because it's really pretty much of an individual thing. There's a few people in the world who are lumped in the same category as me. The difference is all of those people are mentally impaired. They're slightly mentally retarded, and so they don't know what label really to put me in. And the muscle problem progresses, level off, and not in the best shape. And as you get older, you know, you lose strength in your legs or whatever, and a lot of it is I need to do more for my own physical condition.
After the two difficulties you have, the physical difficulty and the eyesight problem, which causes you the most problem, would you say?
Well, I used to say for most all of my life that without a doubt the vision caused the most problems in my life as far as learning and work, but now I probably would say that there's a tie, because as the muscle problems progress, some activities of daily living or whatever are harder, and I guess it's kind of a tie now. Okay. I guess I would like to back up a little bit more back into the school years, Steve, because there's a whole area of my life that I want to share that's difficult to do, and I want to start from the beginning, and that's about around age 15 or 16.
Yes, Steve, that's no problem at all. We're going to come on to that in a minute, and I would like to say that I've had prior permission from Steve to discuss what he's going to discuss shortly. So, Steve, you went to your public school, and what happened there? Did you still want to be involved in mathematics? Were you still really keen?
Well, you know, I loved school. I enjoyed school, and I enjoyed learning, and I guess I wasn't one of the class nerds. I was very gregarious. I loved people, had a lot of friends. I didn't have the bad social experience that I hear from a lot of disabled people, that they were made fun of a lot. I was made fun of in the fifth grade by a guy named Johnny Whitaker, and that was a terrible, terrible year, boy. And I had a girlfriend named Ellen Rennie, and he teased me unmercifully, and he was one of these tough guys, you know, who had been set back 2 years. He was 2 years older than me, and he just would tease me every day. Well, finally, when he started teasing my girlfriend, I got totally fed up, and I challenged him to a fight in the bathroom after lunch. And we went down to the bathroom, and he and his tough friends were on the wall, along the wall, and he just sort of sat real cocky and confident and talking to his friends and said, come on, fight. So I ran up on him. I could walk pretty well back then and even run a little bit. And he just pushed me back like a little toy doll and then kind of pinned me against the sink and slapped me a couple of times. And that made my eyes water because he hit me in the nose, you know. He said, "Well, you're crying," and he made fun of me again. And then I charged him one last time, and he bounced me off of him, and that was the end of that fight. And after that, he never teased me again. I think just by standing up to him, and he would have killed me if he'd wanted to. Standing up to him, he didn't tease me anymore.
Yeah, he probably admired you for doing it. He probably, you know, thought that you wouldn't ever do that. So I'm glad that that little incident was over. And yeah, I'm sorry to hear that you were teased a little bit. I think quite a few disabled people get teased at one time or another in their life. So tell us about your days at your public school, Steve, on the academic side.
Well, all the way from first to sixth grade, I guess, I had a tutor 2 hours a day that would come to the school, and I would leave the class and go into a separate room and do most of the classwork, and then the rest of the time I would be in the class with everyone, and it worked fine, and I was... Well, I love school. I never missed time, hardly. I was never sick after the first grade and second grade. I never missed really time from school. I loved it so much. And well, seventh grade, I was vice president of the class. I don't know. It was just a pretty normal upbringing. Up until this time, didn't know any blind people or any other disabled people. I was the only one, but I really didn't feel different than anyone else because I did pretty much what everyone else did, you know.
Yeah, and you were in that environment, you know. I'm sure you fitted in really well, bullies as well, bullies and all, take on all comers. So, as you got towards the period in your life when you were due to leave school, had you got any ideas in your head as to what you wanted to do for occupation, or did you get any guidance from the people at the school as to what they thought would be suitable for you?
Well, I guess I'd like to talk about high school a little bit here, because this is where things really changed for me. Around the 10th grade, I had started a private school called Collegiate here in Richmond, and all of a sudden the responsibilities changed. No longer did we have one teacher, but we had a teacher for each course. And a lot heavier, harder work, of course. That's what anyone went through. Well, things got a lot harder for me, and I felt like I wasn't keeping up. And I still loved to learn, but was finding it very difficult to do the work, and I didn't know how to. Well, I don't know why this happened, or I started making the choices that I made. I started drinking, and I started drugging in the 10th grade, and I think had a lot to do with was I started feeling less than. All my friends were growing up, and I wasn't. I was a little tiny 5-foot-tall guy who the girls didn't look at me as they looked at other people, and I felt bad about that. And as you grow up, your feelings change about you in relation to the world. I felt very isolated all of a sudden. And I got instant acceptance with this crowd of people at my school. And that was the druggy crowd. And these are the choices I made at age 16, starting around in the 10th grade.
So you think you're starting to use alcohol, and that was to fill some sort of void in your life. Is that how you see it, that the reason was that you just felt so low and you turned to that? Is that a fair assessment of how it was?
I guess it was a couple of things. As I said, I think it was instant acceptance. I mean, if you have something in common with other people who do drugs, and that is that you do drugs, and it was a secretive kind of subculture where you were cool if you did it, and that's all that was required to be accepted. And another aspect of it was, it was a way to ameliorate the pain that I was going through of acceptance problems. And I mean, I didn't have to think about my problems, did I, if I was drinking and drugging? And so it gave me respite. Also, at this time, I really consider that around 16 was the beginning of my adult thinking time. And all my adult thinking time has been spent partially in a spiritual search. So, I think that alcoholics have a spiritual hole in their character, in their spirit, that they try to fill with substance. And they don't even know that it's a spiritual hole, it's a spiritual problem, because it's also a physical thing. When you drink, there is a physical difference in the way we metabolize the substance that is different from people who are not addicted, who are not hooked, that we have no way of knowing about until it gets us. And so there's a physical element, there's a spiritual element, and there's a social element to it that, you know, if I'd known all this at the time, maybe I wouldn't have made the choice. But I could never say that I don't think I would have made the choice, because it was really the best choice I could have made at the time. And that sounds strange to hear. But with the knowledge I had, the options I had, I believe that it was the best choice I could have made at the time. It turned out very bad. It turned out to affect my life in negative ways that I had no way of foreseeing. But how can you look into the future at age 16? I was doing what a lot of other people did, and a lot of people were not affected like me, but I didn't know it at the time. So there's a lot of factors that goes into the why. So I've spent 30 some years examining why, and obviously I have some feeling of why, but I will never have the whys down pat. I don't think anyone does. Why do you do the way you do? Why do you make the choices you make? Well, the choices were made, so what do you do about it? And that's what the focus of my life has been for a long, long time.
Can you describe to us what it's like to crave a substance like you probably crave alcohol and drugs? Can you just give us a little bit of an insight in what it's like to wake up in the morning and try to face the day?
this is going to be hard. You know, everybody deals with this issue, and everyone deals with it in their way. I will tell you as best I can the way I dealt with it. And please try not to personalize it to your life, because it's different, okay? This is the way I dealt with it. In 10th grade, actually it was the summer after my 10th grade, I went to the beach with a friend of mine. And the beach was the place that everyone in the high school went to after school at 8 and partied. You were supposed to party. I had never really partied before, except once. And I went to the beach away from my parents with a friend of mine who, by the way, was not wild, but he sure let me be wild. And, I mean, he was a great guy. I don't put any, not one iota of blame on him. You know, we were just kids doing our thing, and I was drunk the whole time. I mean, I would be sober in the morning, hungover, but then start partying and drinking right as soon as I felt good enough. And I think that was my introduction, was that week at the beach. I had not yet smoked marijuana or done any other drugs. That was very soon to come. And that summer started to progress into marijuana. And then the first half of my junior year, I was introduced to LSD and other things, anything I could get my hands on. In no time, I was hooked on what? Well, just everything. And my joke was, I was hooked to more. You know, somebody would say, "Hey, Steve, you want some more?" I'd say, "Sure." Whatever it was, you know, it didn't really matter. Just whatever would give me the feeling that I had no pain, that everything was okay. So, and I was always in search of that feeling. You never find it. You never really find it as a substance abuser, but that's what you're looking for, is that one moment of nirvana, of feeling that everything is okay. I never did really. Well, I always thought that I can pinpoint one time when I felt that. And then the rest of the whole time was trying to recapture that moment. And I never did. What's it like to feel a craving? Well, I can compare it to wanting a cigarette. The wanting of a cigarette is probably the hardest craving you'll ever have, if you're hooked to them. If you're addicted to cigarettes, then you know what drug addiction is. Wanting alcohol is actually more intense than wanting cigarettes at the time that you want it. Wanting cocaine is probably the worst, and heroin, those things, hard drugs, are the worst. The most intense craving, how can I say? Nothing is all right until you have it. The mental anguish, the anxiety that you experience is a living hell that... that I would not wish on anyone, you know.
Okay, Steve, are you okay? Because I know you're finding this very, very difficult, and I'm sure everyone in the room has nothing but admiration for you to actually share this with us. I'll just give a pause and just tell me you're okay.
Well, first I want to say that the greatest triumph of my life has been getting over it. You know, I haven't done anything since 1987, and,
Yeah, okay, Steve, no problem. We'll move on to happier times, and, you know, I think, we won't press you on that, because it's obviously very, very painful for you. So, when you're ready, just tell us about what happened afterwards, after you left high school, and we'll just take it gradually, and we'll take it gently from there.
Well, gosh, I'm sort of making an idiot of myself, you know. Sorry, it's all over, and I've relived it verbally many times since then, so this is silly. Craving is, well, I already said the worst thing you can have. And so anyway, throughout high school, I sort of lived in between two worlds, the academic world that I aspired to and the drug and alcohol world that I was choosing. And so there was a lot of manipulative behavior on my part, school assignments that were never done, things that, well, you know, I didn't do the best I could in school because of that. Excuse me, I have a phone call. Anyway, the weird part is, hold on one second.
Okay, Steve, just you take your time, take it easy.
I'm sorry, but I just had a phone call. Let's see. I lost my place, Steve. I had a phone call.
Yeah, okay, Steve. We were just you were just trying to sum up your feelings about it. Can I just ask you one more question about the problem you had? Do you realize at the time that you're in a circle of self-destruction, or does it never occur to you that you're not doing yourself any good, to put it mildly, or does that not come into the equation?
Interesting question. I think there are many times when I knew I was being self-destructive. In fact, what would happen is I would get in a really bad way and things would come to a head, and I would involve my family and tell them about it, and then I would go straight for 6 months or so after a family conflict or whatever. And during this time I was totally dry and trying my best, and then I would slip back into it. So I think the whole time I knew that I was being self-destructive, but you see, the disease, the substance, while you're doing it, tells you that you're having a great time. And tell you the truth, I have some happy memories of being totally schnockered, you know. Had some actually happy times with my first wife and with friends and party scenes that seemed rather innocuous at the time, because I was in a group of people, a lot of them were drinking or whatever, but it didn't affect them in their life the same way it affected me. So I would look at them as functioning in their life okay and think, well, I'm just having a good time. I'm not doing anything wrong. It was so bad. I mean, they're making it, so I'm sure I will. And the disease itself puts you in denial to the point that you deny the reality that, hey, this has really changed my life. It's made me miss opportunities, and it's making me miss school, and it's making me do these things. And here I say, it's making me. That sounds like I'm sloughing off responsibility, self-responsibility, and I'm not. I mean, the choices were mine. The disease is a social mental health disease that once you're in it, you can't get out of it by yourself. But every drink you drink, every drug you take, nobody forces you to do it. I chose to do it. So when I say the disease was doing these things to me, I don't mean it in a way that I'm fluffing off responsibility for it. That's another thing that's hard to come to terms with in recovery, is your own responsibility in the face of this disease that gets hold of you. You know, it's a tough thing to really resolve and get a hold of.
Yeah, I'm sure it is, Steve. I'm sure it is. And let's now come on to happier times. And unless there's anything else you want to say on this, I'll leave it entirely up to you. It's very, very hard for you, I know. So is there anything else you'd like to share or say about this period before we move on to happier times for you?
Well, there's a lot, I think, Steve, that needs to be said. Because I haven't given you much of a flavor of the journey. I've given you a snapshot. The journey for me was long and hard and punctuated, like I said, by periods of straight, of trying to stay away from the problem and cure things, okay? I went to college. Actually, I went to three colleges. The first two I didn't do well at because of drinking and drugging. And I ended up at University of Richmond, here where I live, and for 3 years was very studious and very, you know, had a good average in school, very good average. And then met my first wife in a social drinking situation, and for the first year of our courtship was very straight and very social and very involved in my social activity, but not with heavy drinking or drugging. And I was involved in school, not the social life of school, but in the academic part of it, and things went really well. And after about the first year with my first wife before we were married, then I started getting back into it. I mean, the disease was not under control, and so we got into it together. It was a very social, foggy, inebriated time when, on this fourth year of college, I sort of lost it. Well, we got married, and I started working as a receptionist to support our marriage, and I had to quit school, and so during all this time, that was really nothing but a fog, and that lasted a couple of years, and then ended up in a substance abuse program. My wife and I split up, and I had one more year of school. And I'm making a long story short here, believe it or not. And the fourth year of school, after my wife and I broke up, was nothing but a fog. That's the only time I got into social life at college, and it was going to the parties every night and fluffing my way through the fourth year of college, where it ruined my average. I majored in economics, French and Russian, which I learned a lot from those subjects, but the top courses I totally glided through, and there are ways to do that, and I did. Also, I really had no guidance from guidance counselors or counselors of any kind for career placement. So I really, my choice of majors was, it was good if I had continued in grad school, but there's not a whole lot you can do with economics, a BA in economics and foreign languages. So I got out of school. I had no desire to go to grad school, considering what, you know, the time I'd had in the last part of my college. So I got out, and I went back to being a receptionist for a while, and had to quit that job or I would have been fired because of substance abuse. And I got married a second time and glided through that too. I really had no career choice at this time. I tried several things like stockbroking, actually a mutual fund salesman. I tried a lot of volunteer work. At this time, I started meeting some blind people at the Rehab Center for the Blind and got involved in a gardening project for the blind that I was vice director of. And that was had a lot of success, but the director was also a bad alcoholic, and it was another excuse or way to look legitimate and be a sick, very sick individual. There were a lot of other things that I tried for legitimacy, but I never was successful at because of my disease. Kept getting in the way. And I had by this time made some stabs at stopping, but nothing really held. This really went through my 20s and 30s, most of the 30s, the early 30s anyway. And most of the time I was not working for money. I was doing volunteer work. I did the most rewarding volunteer work I did was for the Red Cross. That was for several years, where I was involved in the communications aspect of the disaster action team. I was the chief radio person for the disaster action team. I was also the switchboard operator. That was all volunteer, and it was very, very wonderful service. Except that I wasn't paid, you know, I needed to be paid. And so I had to stop doing that at some point. But that was an incredible time with a bunch of wonderful, wonderful people. And at this time, I did very little drinking and drugging. I was really spiritually fulfilled during this time, you see. I felt like I was contributing. I was with a lot of people who themselves were very centered, wonderful, loving and giving people. And this is the measure. This is one measure of your life, is who do you surround yourself with? Are the people themselves fulfilled in their life? That's pretty much, that's a real good indicator of what's going inside your own spirit, I have found anyway. So I went from the Red Cross, and I got a job at the Rehab Center for the Blind here in Richmond, and worked for money, for pay again, and somehow got very dissatisfied with it. And here's where the substance abuse got at its worst. I was very hooked to cocaine for quite a while. And my performance went downhill. I started off as a great employee and ended up as a very, very undependable employee. And left there. I wasn't fired, but left. My excuse and my feeling was that I was dying inside, that I had no room, no way to advance, that I would be a switchboard operator all my life. There was no intellectual challenge. Didn't really use any of the, quote, intelligence that I had. Although I wasn't really trained to do anything, you know, so, I mean, I was really where I was supposed to be. But I couldn't stand it. I hated it. So I left. And if I hadn't left, I would have been fired because of the cocaine thing. And very soon after that, when I left, a friend of mine said, "Steve, you've got to go to the hospital. If you don't, you'll die." And it didn't take a whole lot of convincing on his part. I had just sold my stereo and all my music to pay the dealer, you know, and that really brought home to me that, Steve, you're totally out of control. And, you know, for a drug addict, it takes different things to bring it home that they're out of control and that they have to make a change. Well, that finally convinced me when I was, you know, sitting in my apartment with no music, no TV, no nothing. And it was just nothing to listen to but my own sick thoughts. And that brought it home. And so I went to the hospital, and I went to a two-week rehab program, and then I went to Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, and those two organizations saved my life. Without a doubt, I have no doubt that if it were not for those two organizations, that I wouldn't be here. I really don't know why I'm here anyway, because of some of the things I went through. But but it still wasn't easy, and it wasn't a straight line recovery. I mean, I relapsed several times, and over the next 2 years. I said I hadn't done anything since 1987. That was a slip. It was 89, really. That was my last use, July 4th, 1989. I got totally snockered at a pool celebrating July 4th, and that's been the last time. But over those 2 years, there were several slips, and then trying to get back on my feet and blah, 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 and I finally did. Well, from, let's see, 91 is when I decided that I wanted to get into computers. I started hearing of blind people that were into computers, and so I think I'll let up the key here, Steve, and let you say something. Maybe we can continue at that point.
Yes, Steve. Can I just pull you back just a little bit and just ask you why you think that Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous played such a large part in your recovery? Obviously, you knew at this time that you'd got to straighten yourself out if you could and so on, but what is it about those two organizations, would you say, that really helped you to recover and become the man you are today?
Well, as I said, I believe that the real symptom of the disease is a spiritual symptom, a missing something in the spiritual life. And all the way from age 16 till even now has been a spiritual searching. Throughout the years of substance abuse, I did a lot of dabbling in Christianity and different types of belief systems. Nothing really way out or anything, but a lot of reading of spiritual books, of self-help books, of books that tried to explain me to me, and a lot of spiritual endeavors, New Age type of groups, and as I say, nothing really way out or weird, but maybe certainly on the liberal side of Christianity, and this was part, very much a part of all these years. I mean, I wouldn't go to these things drunk. Of course, this would be during the sober times, and the introduction of NA and AA was a continuation of that, and it was a step-by-step map of the spirit and a journey by which you can regain, number one, the understanding that there is another power. Number two, you can start to regain some self-respect because you start making better choices and you're around people that themselves are making better choices. So they teach you how to make the choices. And when you're around people that are making better choices, you finally start to learn to make better choices. Now, you're around people, some of whom don't want to be there, some of whom do. And once the fog lifts from your own mind, you can start to discern the difference between the people there who want to be there and who don't. Those who don't are the ones who, unfortunately, the fog doesn't lift, you know, and you can go to those organizations for the purpose of finding cronies that aren't ready. You know, you can go there and find some good drugs if you want to, or you can go there and you can find that instead of drinking and drugging, you can start to face life. You can start to feel the feelings of pain and fear, anger, that you were not able to deal with, and probably the reasons that you even started. It's a road map, and it's painful. It's not easy to go through, and especially in the early years, the first and second years, because, man, you're being torn apart inside, you know. How do you learn to deal with your fears and your anger? And maybe I could talk a whole hour just about fears and angers and resentments. And so these organizations give you real ways to deal with that. And that's why. And I started seeing some great lights, people that I considered lighters of the way, people that for me were the roadmap, you know, the example. Some of them had gone further into the depths of addiction than I had, and a lot of people had. And a lot of them recovered incredibly, you know, so they're the ones that you follow. And then you fake it until you make it, you know, you have all these conflicting feelings inside you. But you fake it, and you just keep going, you know, keep going with it even when you don't want to. And then you have these people on your side, and they're pushing you along. And if they see you getting off the track, then they say, come on, let's...
Yeah, obviously they had a very, very big influence on you, Steve, and thank God you actually found those people and that you were able to learn in a spiritual way from other people's experiences and come out the other side of a very, very dark period. Anyway, if you're okay, if you're ready, you better continue. Let's now come on to 1991. I think that's where we were. And your involvement with these machines were all sitting in front of or at the side of the computer. Tell us about your involvement with computing.
Yeah, so I started seeing computers as something that was really important, that it could be an avenue that would afford things for the handicapped and the blind that I could only dream of before, you know. And so in 1991, that's when I heard that there was technology that would read what's on the computer, and that I could use, instead of a keyboard, use my voice for input. In other words, I could talk to the computer, and then the computer would talk to me, and I wouldn't have to use the monitor, and I wouldn't have to use the keyboard, because I can't type very well. You know, my hands just don't work that well. So in 1991, I heard it was possible. I have a real bad connection. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit, Steve, but no problem. Go ahead.
So anyway, I researched, and I found this guy in Washington, D.C., just about 100 miles from where I live, who was a dealer in computers and adaptive software. His name was Carl, and I talked to him, told him my needs, and discussed it all with him. He said it is possible to do. And we talked about all the equipment that would be needed, and we came up with a quote for $28,000 for the equipment and software at that time. And, you know, I lived on disability. I had no $28,000. So I came up with this idea. I went with a sighted friend to a library. We researched and came up with a list of 500 companies that had foundations, charitable foundations, that gave to technological causes. And I came up with a blurb about me with newspaper articles or whatever. I tried to make myself look good, you know, and sent this package out to these 500 companies. And waited for responses, and I got maybe 100 responses saying that we only give to causes that benefit more than one person, that we really wish you luck, and blah, blah, blah. So that try did not work. So my plan B was to go to the Virginia Department for the Visually Handicapped, and so I went to them and said that I wanted to be a programmer, and is there any way we can do that? So I told them that I was in touch with Carl and he could help us with the equipment. At the time, the Department for the Visually Handicapped had no idea what to do with someone like me who had physical problems as well as visual. So it took actually 2 years on the waiting list to get me into the Woodrow Wilson Rehab Center, which is a rehab center for physical. But they did have a computer programming course. They would take me the way along with the visual part, my introduction to computers, and it was an explosion of learning. It was incredible. I worked, you know, 12, 16 hours a day, way above and beyond what most people were doing because I loved it. I just loved it. And I was there actually for 18 months. At the end of that time, the teacher of computer programming said that I would not be able to continue because the technology wasn't there. You see, the voice input part and the screen reader, which at the time was Vocalize, could not access the mainframe computers in the way that it had to be done. You could do it with a screen reader, but you could not do it with the voice input. So I almost graduated from programming, but didn't. And for the first time I can say it wasn't because of my failure. I think it was their failure. But so anyway, I got out of there in 1995 and got a computer and got Vocalize and Drag and Dictate and went from there. And very soon, in 6 months, went to JAWS because I went to Windows. You know, and there was a product called JAWS. So I didn't use Vocalize anymore. I don't want to make this too long, this part of it. But I got better and better at teaching and started helping people and found that I felt I was a pretty good teacher, and a lot of people who I'd taught thought I was too. So I worked as a contractor for the state and as a teacher for a couple of years, and had my problems because of problems that I had, really, because of habits that I had built up over a lifetime of substance abuse. I mean, I was a really good teacher, but I was terrible at the documentation of it and getting the reports in and stuff like that. And these were really obstacles in my way. They turned into those anyway. But I still felt like I was a good teacher and was. But I sort of just stopped teaching through that avenue and found For the People through audio tips and through For the People have just, here I am.
Just tell us briefly, Steve, what sort of thing you were teaching these other people. Well, I take it you were breaking up a little bit with me at the time. I take it there were other blind people at the Association for the Blind there in Virginia. What sort of things were you actually able to teach them?
I didn't teach anyone who was only blind at that time. I taught the people who were blind and had other learning disabilities or physical disabilities, people who needed dragging with jaws. I was the only one around, really, who could do it and wanted to do it, but I was the only one around who could do it because I had done it, and I actually had something, a lot to do with the interface between jaws and dragging, and so I was the man to ask. And so I never really had just blind people, but several people really changed their lives, and I feel very fortunate and very good about myself that I'm able to contribute and was able to contribute to their transformation. And there's one guy named Scott that I hope you all meet someday on here who is probably the primest example of what computers have done for a multiply handicapped person. And I had the privilege of working with him, and then a lot of senior citizens and a lot of people with learning disabilities, different types of emotional and other problems, but never just blind people.
I'm sure you enjoyed your time as teaching these other people. Were you teaching them word processing and stuff like that? How to use JFW and that sort of thing? Is that what it meant? Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, well, I taught WordPerfect, InDOS, and Word, and mostly about Windows and the interface, things that you had to do to maintain your computer. Also a little bit of Excel. I never really taught Access. I taught a lot about email and browsing. You know, the basics of computing. I'm really not a programmer, although I fancy myself a programmer sometimes. And we can talk about the scripting a little bit if you want to. But I'm mostly taught just personal computing.
Okay, fine, Steve. Now, you did mention For the People, and you found it via another website. And when was that? What year are we now? Probably late 90s. Or no, it would be later than that, wouldn't it? You tell me. Don't let me guess. You tell me.
Well, I think, how old is For the People? Because I was here from the beginning, you know, 2.5 years old now. It'll be 3 years in August, I think. And I was here probably the first week. I mean, I was in the transition. There was Dennis and Jennifer, and of course Jennifer, the main force of it all, and the owner. There were a few other people, and during that week they were looking for a home. They went to, I think it was called Excite or something, one of the major search engines had a voice, a little voice program that you could use, and I was sort of peripherally in on all that, so I was in on the beginning. I've been here ever since.
Yeah, Yes, indeed. I remember when I first came on, you were probably one of the first people I spoke to 2.5 years back. Now, tell us about your involvement with these famous scripts of yours for Chatterbox. How did that come about? Was that your idea to try and make the client easier for us to use as JFW users?
Actually, I went to Florida during my association with the state of Virginia to learn scripting in 1997. And I went to a 3-day seminar, which, by the way, at that time was not a very advanced course. It was an introduction. And I really did nothing with it at the time. So I forgot everything I learned. I mean, the scripting that I've done is not because of the scripting course that I took in Florida, but it does show my interest in it, you know. So I'd had a little taste of it. And then when we had Lipstream in the very beginning of For the People, I started to try to script the room on Lipstream. And that was very frustrating because I was totally a beginner, really. And it would have taken a lot more advanced scripting than I was able to do. I thought it was pretty close to getting it done, and I sort of was, when Lipstream died. And that was frustrating because I'd done all this work. Well, so a month or so later, when Jennifer found the Chatterbox and we went to that, I sort of was the logical one to try it and try to do scripts because Chatterbox was a good client, but it was not that easy to use by the blind. And there was lots of information on the screen that we weren't hearing, so I started writing scripts. And I did a lot of earlier versions of scripts that were free, and I gave them freely. And for about, I was looking at the old scripts the other day. I started that in October of 2001, and then started the paid scripts. Oh, I can't remember. It was February 7th, I believe, in 2001. I didn't release them until April. It took a lot of work and a lot of time to do it. So, anyway, I just did it by default because no one else was doing it, and I had the interest, I guess.
Thank goodness you did, Steve. We'd be absolutely lost without them now. Now, without getting too technical, because I'm only a simple soul, can you just explain briefly to me what a script is and what it actually does? Because you said there's a lot of information on the screen. Now, be gentle with me, Steve, because I'm no computer person, but just try and explain to me what your scripts actually do, how, you know, what they actually do for us. If, as a sighted person, what would a sighted person see on the screen when they look at a room like we're in now? And how are your scripts able to assist? Now, probably that's probably a massive question for you, but if you could just put it in simple terms for us.
I guess the main feature of the scripts as they've evolved is that it speaks automatically information that a sighted person can easily see, information that we need to hear, such as the people who come into the room, people who leave the room, or text messages that we don't like to use too much, but there are some reasons for using texting in some rooms. And without scripts, we could still use it with JAWS or Window Eyes by using the review cursor or the JAWS cursor in JAWS. But how do you know when to use it if you don't hear any indication? So it's just easier to use the scripts. You don't have to have them. The scripts are, after all, a luxury item. It was pointed out to me because they cost money, and you can use the program without the scripts. But it just makes it easier to be able to hear immediately when it appears on the screen, whatever information you want to hear. So you hear who comes in the room and who leaves, and the text messages. You can find out who's in the room. You can have Jaws spell the names of the people in the room. You can read your connection. You can read the message window in its entirety or cycle through the messages with your Grove key. You can do things like, nifty things like grab the email address that was put into the window and automatically grab it and put it into the to field of a new email message if you want to email somebody who gives you their email address in the message window. Likewise, a URL that's typed into the window, you press a key and it takes you right to it. Lots of other nifty things that I don't want to make this a big advertisement for the scripts. But I will say that as of now, and just very recently, the last couple of days, I do not handle the distribution of the scripts that it is sold in for the people mall. The Peeps Mall now is where you get the scripts, and they're still the same price, $20 U.S., and for the people get some of that money. I still get some of it. I still register the scripts and support the scripts. So that part of it hasn't changed.
Okay, Steve, that's useful information. I'm sure people will be talking to you about that in the near future if they want to make inquiries. You also play other roles on for the people as well. I know you're one of the moderators, and we thank you for doing that job, and you also do news and views with Cliff, don't you, when I'm asleep in the middle of the night for me. How would you say For the People has impacted on your life since you found it?
Well, that's the easiest question, Steve. I think there's no one on For the People who has gained more than me from For the People. After all, I profit from the scripts. So money-wise, it's been a good journey with For the People, and I appreciate that. And I feel and hope that I've returned value there. But I've also met Hallie. You know, the little shepherd girl is my soon-to-be wife and my significant other, and I see no end to that. I hope there will be no end to that. I met a wonderful lady on here, and that's impacted my life. I've also made incredible friends that I love dearly, and many of whom, most of whom I haven't even met face to face. So it's hard to count the ways that I've benefited from For the People. So as part of my recovery and my history or whatever, I crave needing or feeling like I have contributed, and so I try to contribute, and you know, it's part of recovery, and so I do news and views the best I can. I do 3G support group, and that's a support group for the blind that meets on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock Eastern time. And I also do some of the spotlight interviews, not as well as you do, but I try to learn from you and how to do interviews. I do cabaret sometimes. I'm trying to make myself available to anyone as best I can to help them with computer problems, and also to offer guidance in the management of the site as best I can. I'm certainly not major in that regard, but to the best I can, I want to help Jennifer, and I want to thank Jennifer really for giving me the brightest years of my life and the greatest avenue for my talents and for me to extend my need to feel like I'm contributing. That's what Jennifer has given me, that's what For the People has given me, and that's what everyone on For the People has given me, and I want to sincerely, you know, kiss everyone's foot, and I mean that, and say thank you for letting me do what I can and be here and being my friends. It's just been an incredible journey, and I don't see an end to that either.
Yeah, from our point of view, Steve, can we thank you for all your contributions to For the People? You do contribute a heck of a lot, and we'd all be poorer if you weren't there to help and to be around and to offer assistance and contribute in the way you do. I think that's a really good place, Steve, to thank you once again for sharing with us your life. And just in final comments, I'd just like to thank Becky for all her help and so on. It's been a privilege speaking to you, Steve, and well done. And if I could pat you on the back, I would. Okay, I'll pat you on the back long distance. Cheers, Steve. It's a great pleasure knowing you.
Well, you're one of the best friends I have on here, Steve, and that's hard to pinpoint because there's a lot of incredible people on here. I appreciate it. So I guess we can open up for questions if you want to, Steve, or if we have time or whatever. You all do whatever.
Okay, Steve. I'll pass it over to the room, and well done. Thanks.
Just thank you to both of you for me. And Steve, thanks for sharing the story of your recovery. And it's a success story. And I think we all admire you for your honesty and for the strength to recover and for all you do for us. Great interview.
Yeah, it was real good. Both Steves did a great job. And Steve, you did great. You know, with everything you've done, and like you said, with the site and everything you do. Thanks much.
Steve, I was going out, actually. I've sat here absolutely, well, I don't think I've ever heard such a wonderful story. Steve, I'm jolly proud to know you, I really am. Thank you very, very much indeed for all what you said, and it must have been very difficult for you at times, but well, all I can say is thank you for all what you've done. Thank you for you spent 2 hours with me one evening sorting things out, and I never forget that. And well, I'd pat you on the back if I could reach you, but sorry, so I haven't got a long enough arm, Steve.
Well, thanks, Bill. I appreciate it what everyone said.
Well, Steve, I just want to say that you're a very, very dear friend to Ray and me, and we really admire all that you've done, all that you've accomplished. And I'm just really proud that you're strong enough now to go forward with your life, and I know that you'll continue. And I just thank God for you and all that He's done for you. We love you, Steve.
Steve, I have to say that I don't know anybody that puts in any more time helping people on the site, trying to get, if it's computer problems, if it's just general questions, it doesn't matter. Steve will be there, give you a time that he can be. He puts in a lot of time, and he genuinely, I'm honest, I've met you. Not met you personally, but.
Steve, I'd like to thank you for sharing your story. This just brings to bear the truth that life is hard, but God is good. So thanks a lot, and you just keep on keeping on, and anytime I can be of assistance to you or just be a friend, I'm only a couple keystrokes away.
Steve, hi, this is Pauline. I know it says Rick, he's my husband. But I just had a question for you. If you could offer advice to college young people, people in, say, junior, senior year of high school, who might get involved with these same kinds of temptation, drugs, alcohol, etc. What advice would you offer them to help them get through those years without the entanglements that you had to suffer through?
Boy, what a question that is, because when if you're talking to a person who is bound and determined to make the wrong choices, they're going to make them. But on the other hand, you don't give up. You say what you can to them. What would I say? I would say, look toward the best in your life. Always reach for the best. Always copy the best. The people who have clear eyes, the people who have their eyes on the future, not the people who walk around with their eyes pointing downward all the time, or the people who see life as a trap, but the people who see the possibility of life. That's what I would say to people. You can't just say no. That doesn't work. You have to give them something to reach for and try to reinforce the importance of reaching for the best.
Do you think by offering them goals they can achieve, that might help give them direction for their lives, that kind of thing?
It could. But the trouble with that is it's hard to give somebody a goal. Goals are grabbed for. They're taken, you know. If a person is given a goal, then usually it's not their goal to reach for. So that's a hard, you know, it's a great idea, but how do you give someone a goal that they take hold of, you know? It's got to be from them.
Hi, Steve. Of course, this is Mar. And I guess I just want to add to everybody's sentiments that I just admire you for having the courage to be so incredibly candid. And, you know, if you've influenced one person's life by what you said, which I'm sure you have, it's a great thing that you've done. My question, though, is on a completely different nature. Since you are partially sighted and you do read the screen, and I know I've asked you this personally, but I think it might be interesting to everybody. When you actually write your scripts, do you do so as a totally blind person would do it, or do you need to depend upon your sight to be able to do that procedure?
Oh, well, I don't see the screen enough to get the information from it. No, I don't read the screen with my eyes. I use JAWS. If I could use my eyes, I would, but I think that the partial sight I have, I do get a little bit of information, like I can see the shape of the message window, and I can see the border of the shape of the user list window is under that. So I can see the shape of the windows. But I don't think this helps in scripting. In fact, if anything, it's gotten in the way more than helped. I think a totally blind person, maybe in the process of scripting, there's a couple of questions a scripter would ask a sighted person. Very few, and most of it is done without any vision at all. I've asked my friend Fred, who's here a lot, that, you know, things about what's going on the screen. But if he weren't here, and I couldn't ask him, I could have found it out probably some way with JAWS. In general, no, I don't think having partial sight or sight helps in scripting at all. And I've heard that argument. I've heard people say that you have to have sight to script. I think that's totally wrong.
Steve, is magic of any use to you at all?
Magic being the magnifying program that Freedom Scientific has. Well, actually, if I used magic and I magnified the text 20 times. I could see the text for about 5 minutes. I could maybe scroll the text and look at it, but it's only one or two words on the screen at that point, and it's not very practical. And after about 5 minutes, my eyes get too tired to use it. It helps a little. It would help a little bit, but not enough to justify it for me. And I don't know. It's just not that helpful to me.
I have a really strange question. It's totally off from anything anybody else has asked, but I noticed in your interview that you talked about having a twin. And you didn't go into any more detail about that, but I'm kind of curious about it, about the relationship you had with your twin brother and what that was like and your interaction with him when you discovered your visual and your physical problems. And did he have any? Probably not, because you didn't mention that. I was just kind of curious about the twin thing, if you have anything to say about that, and how that was in school. Did he like school? Were you guys close, or did that cause you to drift apart? You know, just do something on the twin thing. I was kind of intrigued about that.
Boy, that's a whole big thing. He died in 94. My brother was gay. He died of AIDS. And he spent the last 9 years of his life going through the hell of AIDS. He was my fraternal twin, meaning we were not identical. We were very close in the early years of our life, but as we progressed through school, it became evident that I didn't know he was gay at that young age, but he was very sissy-ish in his manner. And I think with my own insecurities about my abilities being less than other boys, I hated the fact that he was sissy-ish. And I think I made fun of him a lot, and we drifted apart. And then by the time I accepted his sexual preference, which I did do in my 20s, we had drifted apart so much that it was a chasm there that we never really gulfed, never really bridged. And so we weren't close all the way up until he died, and that was a big regret in my life. And I loved my brother, but I couldn't share it with him. And that's one of the big pains and regrets in my life, too. He was not academically oriented at all. And I think, too, when we were young and I was first getting sick, I was the one that was paid all the attention. You know, I was sort of in this position of king in the family, the one who got the attention. And he was pushed aside. I just can imagine how tough that was for him. I was the gregarious one, the one that got along with all the adults. And so I was the one paid attention to. And he must have resented that on some level. But I'll never know. I don't really know. And I think maybe I kind of ate up the attention. I left it on up, and it caused a lot of chasms.
Yeah, I didn't mean to open a big can of worms there, but what did he have problems with substance abuse as well as you, or not?
That's a question. Certainly not like I did. He drank very much toward the end, but he never affected his life in the way that it affected mine. So I can't judge whether he had a problem. You learn as a recovering substance abuser never to judge someone else. In that way, you try not to. So that wasn't a big thrust in his life that I know of.
Well, that's a good enough answer. I was just kind of curious about the whole twin and the genetic thing of it, you know.
Yeah, genetically we were no more related than regular brothers. We were fraternal twins, which means two sperm, two eggs, just as if we were brothers. And so the genetic component, wasn't there.
Well, it could have been. I mean, you were brothers as far as the substance abuse. I was just curious. Since you were twins and the same age and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, very true. It's just that by the time the substance took hold of me, we were no longer really in the same social group. We were to an extent. Remember I told you I was in two worlds. Well, he wasn't in the world of the drug abusers. He was in the other world that I was still a part of.
There you go. Now you're kind of getting more to what I was, I guess. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, also the school I went to, there were only 50 people in my class, so it was hard not to be a part of something with everyone, you know. Well, there were 50 boys and 50 girls, so 100 total. So it was a pretty small environment, and you were either a jock, which I certainly wasn't a jock, or you were what we call the freak, or you were the guys that people made fun of, the sissies. So the only group I could identify with really was the freaks, and that's the one I went to.
Well, at least you weren't, nowadays they call them nerds. At least you weren't a nerd.
Yeah, in my school, the nerds really were not made fun of. They were sort of just there, you know. They were in the background. And I liked them. The guy that I went to the beach with that year was a nerd. And I got along with him fine.
Nerds are what make the world go round when you get right down to it. Nerds are what make us be able to talk on these things, probably.
Yeah, you're right.
Steve, I have to leave, but I admire you for being so candid this afternoon with us, and I found that to be a very, very fascinating interview, and I thank you.
Steve, I think that interview was great. And you are an inspiration to everybody.
I have to agree, Lee. Thank you very much, Steve, for a wonderful interview. Took a lot of courage to do that, and I'm mighty glad you have struggled through all that you've had to struggle through. You've certainly helped an awful lot of us here, and we're counting on you to continue to be there for us, because I don't know what we'd do without a Steve Shepherd here. And Steve, in fact, has our interview for Spotlight next week. He'll be interviewing Randy, a.k.a. Dollface, and we hope everyone will come back next week and hope we don't have the technical problems. But once we got started, Steve, you noticed it just was pretty much smooth going. So somebody's been watching over us this afternoon to make sure your story got told. And thanks again, Steve.